Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the PFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Lauren Aguirre about her new book, The Memory Thief and the Secrets Behind How We Remember, a Medical Mystery. The remarkable true story of a team of doctors who, throughout years of scientific sleuthing and observant care, discover a surprising connection between opioids and memory, one that holds promise and peril for any one of us. How could you lose your memory overnight? And what would that mean? The day neurologist Jed Barash sees the baffling brain scan of a young patient with a devastating amnesia marks the beginning of a quest to answer those questions. Through the prism of this fascinating story, Aguirre goes on to examine how researchers tease out the fundamental nature of memory and the many mysteries still to be solved. But at its core, Aguirre's genre-bending and deeply reported book is about paying attention to the things that initially don't make sense, like the amnestic syndrome, and how these mysteries can move science closer to an ever-evolving version of the truth. Well, Lauren, welcome to the show.
Hi, Galina. I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, it's really great to have you here today with us. So as we have witnessed the unprecedented times of the recent global pandemic, well, in the midst of which we really still are, but hopefully, you know, it's tending towards the end, I was wondering if you would reflect on how has it affected you and your work, and maybe some main takeaways that you have gathered from this experience.
Sure. So I was extremely fortunate, both personally and professionally. I was at a point in the book where I had done all the major research and the kind of research that really needs to happen face to face with people, where you can see their surroundings and get to know them and have them get to know you enough to trust you to tell their story. So when the pandemic arrived, I was really at a point where I could do follow-up interviews over Zoom and FaceTime and what have you, and that worked. Of course, for them, it was pretty bad because experiments had to be put on hold. So that was very different for them. But for me, it allowed me to focus on finishing up writing the book and also saying, okay, well, I guess I need to stop writing because really nothing else is going to be happening anytime soon. And then personally, I was also extremely fortunate because, you know, my work I was able to continue doing. And, you know, my kids, the ones who weren't home anymore, came home. And we were able to spend the kind of time together that, you know, hadn't happened since they were in elementary school. So that kind of closeness with the family was, it'll never happen again. So that was really something to treasure. And then, you know, it was clear how fortunate we were also in that my daughter works with seniors in a senior living center. And so, you know, she would just come home and tell me about, you know, the devastation there and how hard it was for the seniors when she had to go around and say, we can't do activities anymore. You can't leave your room. It was just devastating for them. And then she did actually bring coronavirus home to us unwittingly. She was asymptomatic. So four of the six of us in our family had it early on in the pandemic. But, you know, we didn't suffer. We had family time. I think we just learned to be more grateful for what we have.
Oh, that's excellent. I just hope you don't have any long-lasting symptoms after, and hope you recover.
Yeah, I did lose my sense of smell for a while, but it's back. So I think I'm okay. We'll see.
Excellent. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. So I grew up in the Boston area where I still live. My father was a mathematician. My mother was an English teacher. So I sort of combine those two loves. I always loved science. I loved writing. I loved languages. And it occurred to me that I could perhaps put those two loves together and become a science journalist. And I was fortunate in that MIT at the time was just starting up a science writing program. So I applied and got in, somewhat to my surprise. And it was just a fantastic education because you had to learn all the core, you had to take all the core courses and labs. But then I also got to take classes on science writing and communication. And so it was the perfect education, and it really gave me the confidence to believe that I could, you know, if I worked hard enough, I could understand something. And then the next challenge was, okay, now that I understand it, how do I explain it to someone else? And how do I motivate them to want to understand it? Because, you know, ultimately I want to translate my love of learning and share the fascination of whatever new thing I learned with other people. So being at MIT really gave me the background and the courage to do this job. And then from MIT, I went to NOVA, which is a science documentary series on public television here in the United States. For UK listeners, Horizon is sort of the sister series. And so that was an anthology series. And I got to cover all kinds of topics. It could be human origins. It could be art restoration. It could be, you know, doomsday asteroids. And then I launched our website, so I got to explore other formats for science storytelling. We had podcasts, you know, we started a digital magazine, we did these real-time online adventures. But throughout, so it was an interesting challenge to say, how can I use this medium best to tell the story I want to tell? But it always comes back to, you know, who is your audience? What are their expectations? And where are they? You know, are they in the car driving? Do they have 5 minutes or 5 hours? Or are they on the couch? And what do they know? And then how can you lead them through? Because even though you're not technically interacting with them, you are having a sort of conversation and trying to lead them along the path. Okay, they know this now. What do I need to say to make them interested in the next thing that I have to say? And that was, you know, true in the book as well. There was just a much, much bigger canvas to draw on to do that. In terms of also what I learned at NOVA, which is just as true in my book, The Memory Thief, it was so interesting in certain fields when there wasn't a lot of data or there was a lot of confusion, how tightly people clung to their beliefs as if, you know, science is a belief system. It shouldn't be about beliefs, but it didn't really matter the field. You know, we did a story on the restoration of the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo's frescoes, and the restoration involved cleaning them. Basically, they were filthy with centuries of smoke, so they were brown. And a famous art historian had built his career explaining the various shades of brown and what they meant. So, you know, when they started cleaning it was all these gorgeous hues. He just couldn't understand it, and he couldn't accept it. So, you know, that comes up again and again and again, that people have built their careers around a certain idea. And it's very hard when new information comes along that contradicts that. It's hard to integrate that or to say, well, this thing I've been working on for 20 years isn't quite right.
Mm. Oh, that's fascinating. And your passion for science, you can really, really feel it throughout the book. So I was wondering, have you ever had an inkling of pursuing the actual science career, or are you still not really?
I did. I almost changed majors. I really loved organic chemistry, which surprised me. You know, maybe it was one of the few courses that somehow came naturally to me and not to others so much. And that was a nice position to be in for once when something wasn't so hard. But I realized I really didn't have the patience to focus in on one topic for a whole career. And so being a science journalist really suited me better because I got to explore so many different topics and speak to so many different experts. It's a really privileged position that you get to go and talk to people about, you know, their whole life's worth of research. You get the highlights. And, you know, I just love talking to scientists. I'm always so energized when I finish a conversation with one of them. But what was interesting about writing my book was that it wasn't the lifetime of research. I was actually following it as it happened, which is different. You go down the blind alleys and you don't know they're blind alleys until you get to the end. So it was quite different from covering, say, stories that we would do for NOVA.
And along your career journey, what roles did mentors play, and perhaps your colleagues as well? And maybe you have some advice for younger aspiring journalists?
Well, you know, I learned something different from everyone that I worked with. Some people I learned how to negotiate, because a lot of producing is, you know, getting access to something or getting people to believe they should talk to you. I learned persistence, but most of all, I learned to listen. I already had the sort of prepare in my, it's just part of my constitution. But you go in with your plan and then you need to be willing to, you know, stray from it and respond to what's happening in front of you. So some of the best advice I got from an editor that I had worked with at NOVA, I had a coffee with her when I was just starting out on the book. And I said, you know, what advice do you have for me? And she said, Lauren, you are always very well prepared, but make sure you listen. Just let the other person talk and talk and talk and talk, because you'll learn something that you didn't even realize you needed to ask about.
So this marriage of your really unbridled curiosity about science combined with a beautiful writing culminated in your latest book, The Memory Thief. So can you tell us what is it about and how did you come to writing it?
So it's a story about a strange new type of amnesia caused by opioid overdose. And then what that can tell us about how medical science advances, about the science of memory, and then about possible cures or treatments for memory disorders, most notably Alzheimer's disease. And I came across this story, you know, the seed was planted before the story even began. So back in 2009, I had an experience of, you know, dramatic memory loss myself, where I had this aura that came over me early one morning. I was probably working too early. And, you know, suddenly I was overcome by this feeling of impending doom. And then at the same time, my memories basically slipped away. So, you know, I had awareness without knowledge. I didn't know who I was, what my name was, you know, where in history I was, you know, nothing made sense. And it was so terrifying that I lay face down on the floor and shut my eyes and waited for it to pass. And then of course I went to my doctor and she said, oh, that sounds like a seizure and you might have a brain tumor. So from there, it was a long kind of journey of lots of tests and lots of second opinions and, you know, someone saying you need to have brain surgery. So one of the people that I asked for informal second opinions was Jed Barish, the neurologist who discovered this amnestic syndrome. That's the topic of my book. And he was a neighbor, and I asked him to come over and take a look at my scan, and he did, and he looked through it, and he said, you know what, you're going to be fine. This is not a big deal. You just need to take your medicine every day. I would not have surgery. And I was really struck by, you know, the pragmatism there and his decency. So, you know, I followed his advice and I never had the surgery and I take my medicine and I've never had another seizure. So it just left me with an appreciation for how weird brains can be. You know, why did this suddenly happen to me? Because I do have a sort of, I have a brain lesion. But aside from that, it's never affected me to my knowledge. So it left me with that really deep appreciation for how scary it is to lose your memory, which honestly, I'd never really thought about before. So then when Barish started to come across these people who had overdosed on opioids and lost the ability to form new memories, that just seemed really interesting to me in a way to explore the brain and explore how science advances really in depth in a way that you can't even do in an hour-long documentary.
This is definitely an extraordinary experience that you described, and it's quite admirable that you can share this experience. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. I think it's really important. You know, there's a stigma around epilepsy. There's a stigma around a lot of diseases still, including substance use disorder, which is a topic in my book. And I just think the more that people are willing to talk about it, the better.
So your book goes into a very nice science. So let's start and delve a little bit into that. So what is memory and where can we find it?
So memory, you know, technically speaking, we all think we know what it is, but it's the ability to encode, store, and then remember or recall consciously or unconsciously information, skills, experience. You know, when we think about memory, when we talk about, oh, I have a bad memory or I have a good memory, we're talking about really one type of memory, explicit memory, the things that we know that we know. But that isn't all of memory. And then there's the learning part of it. So learning is intertwined with memory. You can't form a memory unless you learn, which is acquiring new information in a way that your knowledge or your behavior might change. So, you know, without learning, there's no memory possible. As to, you know, where it is, that's something that's still being worked out and will always be worked out. It isn't certainly in one part of the brain or the other. So the hippocampus is really plays a starring role in my book because you can't form new explicit memories without a functioning hippocampus. But it's not like all your memories live in hippocampus. They live in distributed networks of connected neurons across the brain in the relevant brain areas that kind of make up that memory. So if it's what's called an episodic memory, a memory of an event, those neurons will be in the places of your brain that process sight and smell and sound and emotions, and of course the hippocampus. But, you know, some people would argue that it's not even in specific networks or ensembles of neurons, it's in certain patterns of brain activity, and that you're sort of born with a huge collection of pre-existing patterns of brain activity. And then as you go through life, it's sort of a job of matching up those patterns of brain activity to experience. So whatever state your brain was in at a certain point in time, you know, when you got the news that you had coronavirus, that is a certain pattern. But you could theoretically get rid of all those neurons and still have that memory because you could recreate the pattern with some other ensemble of neurons. So there's this famous, you know, the Jennifer Aniston neurons. And I talk about this briefly in my book, the idea that the memory of Jennifer Aniston is encoded in certain neurons. But, you know, one of the scientists I interviewed said, you know, you are welcome to erase every single one of my Jennifer Aniston neurons with a magic laser. And I guarantee you, I will still remember who she is. Mm-hmm. So memory is many things. It's the explicit memory that I talked about, both episodic, the events that we remember, and then what's called semantic. So knowledge for facts, like who is president or, you know, what color is the sky. And then there's the implicit memory, which we think about less, which is like procedural memory, how to ride a bike, and then kind of Pavlovian or habit memory, sort of learned responses like, you know, the bell rings and you salivate because you know that's become associated over time with the arrival of dinner. But all these categories also sort of bleed into each other or rely on each other. You know, you need memories of events to learn how to ultimately ride a bicycle. So these are all kind of human constructs or names that we have to put on different types of memory to talk about it. But then we also have to remember that, you know, these are the categories that we made up, and our brain could care less about the categories.
Which category would muscle memory go? Is that implicit?
I suppose so. But, you know, I didn't really interview anyone or read about muscle memory, but I think that's probably what people mean, in the sense that you don't think your brain is involved. You just, you mm-hmm. do it. Like you play tennis because you played a million times.
I'll ride a bike.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what are specifically opioids and how are they connected to memory?
So opioids, we have what's called endogenous opioids. We have our own opioids floating around in our body. And then there are exogenous opioids like morphine, heroin, fentanyl, oxycodone, all of those things. And they do multiple things, but the thing that they do related, you know, that we really care about is they ameliorate pain, and they also create a sense of euphoria. So, but in terms of this book, opioids, it turns out, under certain circumstances, can damage the hippocampus. And the way they do that is involves somewhat nerdy science. But basically, there are two main classes of neurons. There are the excitatory neurons that, you know, when you think about the brain, that's what you think about. A neuron gets enough input and then it fires and it passes the signal on, kind of blindly. But then there's this other category of neurons, which are fewer in number, but much more powerful in a way, really the brains of the system. And they're called inhibitory neurons. And their job is to keep things under control. So they're sort of timing, gating mechanisms. And one scientist referred to them as, they're kind of like the bouncers at the bar. And, you know, without them, you know, if someone slipped them a drink and they all fell asleep, you would have utter chaos. So opioids, when they bind to receptors on inhibitory neurons, they shut them down. So suddenly, you know, the bouncers aren't there and your excitatory neurons start firing uncontrollably. So, and if they're firing enough, they will kind of use up all the resources, all the energy, and kind of burn themselves out and ultimately die. So that is the best explanation for why in some people, and it's a very small fraction, in some people who overdose on fentanyl, they wake up the next morning with a severely damaged hippocampus and the inability to form new memories.
So can you give us a glimpse of the story that you tell in your book?
So I actually opened the book in a sort of flash forward with a young man whose story I follow throughout the book. I called him Owen, and he had a very kind of obsessive relationship with memory even before this happened to him. He was very, very concerned about memory and about forgetting things. And he also had a very long-standing substance use disorder with opioids and other drugs. So he had actually been sober for 18 months when he got some news that most people would consider great news. He, like me, had had these auras and was told you might have a brain tumor. And he was actually pretty ecstatic about that because it would give him what he thought was permission to go back to using fentanyl. So, you know, society says that's bad. You know, his family says it's bad and he didn't want to let anyone down. But cancer was the perfect justification for him to go back to using. And then when he got the news that actually, you know, he was fine and there was no tumor, he was so devastated that he went out and used fentanyl and woke up the next morning with the ability, you know, to basically remember things for only about 30 seconds. And his doctors had no idea what had happened and sent him home to live with his family, you know, with a prescription to drink more water. So then I went back from there to the beginning of the story, which was in 2012 when Jed Barish came across the first known patient to develop this syndrome, who had taken what he thought was heroin. But, you know, as we're learning, fentanyl is increasingly being mixed in with heroin and with other drugs. And unless you know to test for it, you're not going to know it's there because it doesn't show up on standard tox screens and people often don't know what they're taking. So, you know, and he had this very, very strange pattern, just like Owen's, of damage just to the hippocampus. And this is really unusual. It, you know, it can happen sometimes with a virus or with a heart attack, but it's extremely rare. And to see it so precisely defined on both sides of the brain and the rest of the brain completely unharmed. So Barish worked with other doctors in Massachusetts and to put the word out through the Department of Public Health. And eventually they gathered 14 such cases. And then it spread to, they found cases in West Virginia and across the country. So it became clear that this was a real thing. Still hard to say, you know, what the scope of it was, like how many people are affected because you know, if someone comes into a hospital after an overdose and they're confused, it's very easy to chalk it up to, well, they overdosed. Of course they're confused. And then they often want to leave the hospital as soon as they can. They're a marginalized population. People don't, you know, sad to say, but care about them in the same way that they would care about, you know, a terrible syndrome that afflicted children. But Owen, then I bring the story back to Owen, the young man who overdosed at the beginning of the book, because once he kind of came out of his immediate fog, he actually went online and found an article that I wrote about the syndrome. And that's how he figured out, oh, that's what happened to me. And he reached out to the neurologists involved and agreed to be tested at University of California, San Francisco at the Memory and Aging Center because, you know, he figured, well, I've really done a terrible thing to myself, which might be permanent, but what can I do to help others? And that's a theme that comes up again and again in the book in terms of the critical role of patients in helping medical science advance. And so he went to the Memory and Aging Center and got tested, and his hippocampus had shrunk by 10%. So between you know, before the overdose and after, because they did have the MRI before, they could tell really precisely. And they could tell that it really was just the hippocampus. And that was the only part of his brain that lost volume. And then his memory, he's extremely intelligent. So they did extensive neuropsychological testing. And he scored near the top of the chart for executive functioning in terms of the ability to plan and reason, but pretty much at the bottom for episodic memory, not surprisingly, because his hippocampus works very, very poorly. So he scores like someone would with Alzheimer's disease. And that's where the kind of the connection with Alzheimer's disease comes in, because Alzheimer's is also sort of ground zero is the hippocampus. And from there, though, it spreads out to other brain regions, and you start with just memory problems in the typical Alzheimer's, and then you slowly lose the ability to plan and to speak and ultimately to move. But, you know, the question that occupied the minds of these researchers was, you know, is it more than just, you know, the hippocampus is involved? Can we use this insight to help us develop tools to better understand Alzheimer's disease and maybe even to treat it? So there was a famous case back in the 80s of another group of people with substance use disorders who overdosed on heroin contaminated, or synthetic heroin contaminated with a toxin, which turned out to cause all the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. So that was the basis for the first animal model for Parkinson's disease, the first way to test treatments for Parkinson's disease. So the hope was, well, you know, if we can figure out and show that opioids really do damage the hippocampus in this predictable way, could that form the basis for an animal model for testing drugs for Alzheimer's disease? So that was kind of one connection. Mm-hmm. Another connection was, what about people who are taking opioids, you know, often as prescribed, but high dose, long term for chronic pain? Is there something that's happening that is less dramatic than this all-out assault on the hippocampus, but still affecting the inhibitory neurons and sort of interfering with memory processing at a low level ongoing every day? And so, you know, the question is that subtly impacting memory in ways that are not obvious, especially in older people who are prescribed opioids at higher rates than the rest of the population and who are obviously at greater risk? So that is actually one theory to come out of this that just received a couple of weeks ago notification that they can move forward. They have a grant from the National Institutes of Health here in the United States to study people at a pain clinic at the University of Pennsylvania. So that study just started up. I think it'll take a year. I don't remember exactly. And then a third hypothesis to come out of this work is, well, if opioids damage the hippocampus, is there a way to turn that insight on its head and protect the hippocampus? And so one of the drugs that is used to treat substance use disorders is called naltrexone, and it's an opioid antagonist. So it blocks the opioid receptors. So would a low dose of naltrexone protect people's memories? By tamping down this kind of hyperactivity of neurons, which is increasingly recognized as a common symptom or feature of Alzheimer's early on in the disease, before you've caused a lot of damage. So those are the three big ideas to come out of the syndrome. And I think, you know, it makes the point that case studies can be really important. And I think they're often kind of scorned and looked down on as sort of second-tier evidence. And, you know, if there are 8 billion people in the world, of course you're going to see something weird every now and then. And what does that really have to do with the rest of us? It can't be important. But it can be important because it reveals that there was something you didn't know. There was something missing. And maybe by understanding that, you can get a fuller picture of that process, in this case of memory and diseases of memory.
Yeah, this is such a fascinating story and really important, and especially in the light of a recent opioid epidemic as well, that's, right. With overprescriptions, for example. But another thing was that really stuck with me is the way that actually researchers approached finding out all of this case itself. So they were acting more like detectives and investigators, weren't they?
Very much so. And I sort of thought of it as guerrilla science, because none of this was, you know, already in a certain lane of research. Mm-hmm. It's pretty weird to have a neurologist investigating opioids, right? It doesn't make sense to people. Or, you know, what possibly could the opioid crisis have to do with Alzheimer's disease? And that's just a limitation of the human brain, is taking in new information that doesn't fit into the boxes that you already have in your head. So it wasn't like an ongoing research project, and it didn't make sense to a lot of people. And, you know, researchers already have their projects lined up. Like, who has time to suddenly take on something new that doesn't have a clear, doesn't clearly fit into their line of research? So the doctors involved all sort of volunteered their time on the side to figuring this out. And it's one of the things I learned that, you know, really surprised me is how much of science actually happens in conversations and, you know, in late night searches on Google. You know, I'm sure that isn't necessarily true for a lot of scientists, but it was definitely true here. And it was fascinating to me how far you could get with just persistence and, you know, asking anyone and everyone for help and just not giving up and thinking about different ways to approach this theory. I mean, there are multiple ways to test a theory. You can look at it from an epidemiological perspective, you know, what data is out there in the population that might support this idea. You can look at it from, you know, testing animals. Is there any evidence with mice? You know, you could, there are a number of ways that you could look at it. You could go back and look at, let's say, autopsy reports from people who've used heroin and have passed away. So, you know, these doctors just kind of kept hammering away at it. And it's remarkable that in, you know, a pretty short time as far as science advances, that they went from what is this mysterious thing that's happening to, okay, it's defined as the opioid-associated amnestic syndrome. You know, you can, it's going into books, it's going into like learning seminars for medical students. People who have this now can kind of go home with the dignity of a diagnosis. And then there are these theories that came out of it that are beginning to be tested. And that, you know, that's personality and it's luck. That's a lot of it.
Yeah, for sure. But also bravery, perhaps, to ask these difficult questions and look into populations which are primarily afflicted by this opioid epidemic, like heroin or fentanyl addicts, for example.
Yeah. Bravery, curiosity, and I would say just stubbornness. Stubbornness can be a good thing.
So as usual, when we discover something new, we learn something new. And you probably learned a lot new things about memory. So can you tell us what kind of questions about memory really, really fascinate you?
Well, so maybe not so much questions as observations. You know, we really like to think that our memories are what happened. And it's so hard to accept, but the evidence is really there that there is no such thing as a pure memory. Every time you remember something, it changes, and it changes because it's not, you know, a tape recording that you pull out of a vault. It's, as I said before, it's like a network of distributed patterns. And so, but your brain is alive and working all the time. So even just your state of mind, when you recall a memory, will then contaminate. If that's, you can use that word, it will contaminate your memory. So something that originally might have been a happy experience, if you remember it in a different frame of mind, it'll be tinged with different emotions. Or if something else was happening at the same time, you might integrate that into your memory. So, you know, memories are not pure. There's no such thing as a pure memory. That was fascinating to me. Another thing that was really fascinating is that, you know, having a not such a good memory can be a good thing in the sense that you really can't remember everything. And in fact, it would be very counterproductive to remember everything because then you fail to abstract the essential meaning of your experiences. Like, you know, if you live in an environment that never changes, maybe it's okay to remember everything. But what you really want is the core concept. And one of the examples that I use in my book, The Memory Thief, is, you know, a soccer ball. If what you're remembering is, you know, the different colors of soccer balls that you saw, or maybe the different sizes because you went to a kid's game and then you went to an adult's game, you will fail to abstract what a soccer ball is in terms of its shape. So that's true for memory as well, that you just shouldn't and can't remember all the details. And for some people who do remember, you know, almost everything, it's actually a curse. I mean, I wish I remembered more than I do. I think there's a happy medium that I haven't quite, that I don't have, but it's sort of reassuring to know that it's good to forget, that that's the other half of making useful memories, which are really there. I mean, they make our lives better when they're good memories, when you can reflect back on things fondly and they create your sense of identity. But, you know, from a very practical perspective, they are there to help you predict the future and to help you make better decisions so that you survive and pass your genes on to the next generation.
Yes, and this fallibility of memory is actually quite counterintuitive, isn't it? We don't really think that our memories are not like a picture or a movie.
Right, right. And then so you get into an argument with someone about, no, that's not what happened. This is what happened. And, you know, you might butt heads about it and no one's lying. It's just their memories became different, which is not to say that there's no truth. You know, it's not like certain memories are going to become completely false. You know, your memory of the delivery of your first child, the basics are going to be there. But, you know, things can change and can change and insert themselves. You know, maybe, you know, the nurse, a certain thing happened that actually happened in another experience. But yeah, memories are fallible. And that's really important to remember in conversations with people. It's important, you know, to be aware of, let's say, in trials that, you know, someone's memory should never be you know, the main evidence against someone because it is so fallible.
But also the concept of false memories. So as we learn more, it's quite obvious that it's possible to sort of implant false memories into both mice and people.
Yeah, and it's shockingly easy. I mean, not so much in mice because it's a complex experimental protocol to prove what you've done. But our brains do not distinguish between, you know, there's no false meter, you know, true meter. It's just patterns of activity. And it's shockingly easy to sort of present information to people within a context that makes sense to them and kind of suggest things. And while you're doing that, they're creating a picture in their brain of what that is. And then it becomes real. And in mice, yes, they've been able to implant memories, you know, fully whole cloth, you know, completely separate from any actual experience, which is quite amazing.
So if we reflect a little bit more on society, so why humans are so fascinated with the memory and their brain?
Well, in a way you could say, you know, how could we not be? It's this 3-pound, you know, ball of gray stuff that is very ugly, frankly. You can't tell what it does by just looking at it. You know, unlike the heart, it's very clear what it does and how it works, or the lungs or the kidneys. But it's not at all clear, you know, just from looking at it, what the brain does. And yet it's who we are. Like, I would gladly sacrifice a limb for my brain. And, you know, you can get a prosthetic leg, you can get a heart from someone else, and still be you. But you can't get someone else's brain. You won't be you anymore. So, you know, people are fascinated in themselves, and, you know, you could argue that the brain is you, and, you know, of all the sort of brain faculties, memory is probably the most you. You know, it's how you create your identity. It's how you make sense of your interactions with other people. It's how you tell the story of your life. So, you know, it's hard not to be fascinated by memory. Although, you know, I will say I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it until I had that, you know, that episode of memory loss. I think, you know, I would think about it in terms of you go to a party and, oh, darn it, you can't remember that person's name. That's what people mean when they say I have a bad memory. But, you know, once you start getting into it or seeing people whose memories don't work, it becomes really fascinating and also really fascinating how little we know given how important it is.
Oh, you're so right that it's easy then to shift your attention to something that we're lacking perhaps. Rather than in general thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So have you asked this question to any of the neuroscientists that you met? Are they also sort of drawn towards complexity?
You know, I did not ask that question. That would have been a good question. I think they certainly can't be averse to complexity because, let's say they have to be comfortable with a lot of uncertainty and a lot of lack of knowledge and, you know, humility about what can be known. And I think they all share that. I don't think you could be a neuroscientist without that frame of mind that it's extraordinarily complex. And, you know, people I talked to really, they were very careful about the difference between what we know and what we think we know and how important it is to remember the basis for your knowledge. Like, what was the experiment that led us to that understanding? And what was it about that experiment that might have sent us, you know, in the wrong direction? Or so never really accepting anything as a fact. It's just, this is what we believe to be true at this point because of this way that we looked at the question.
So you mentioned earlier there were some practical implications of what could have arisen from this story, for example, for patients with Alzheimer's. But what are other major practical or other beneficial applications that we can derive from the research on memory and cases, as you said, the single cases like that one of Owen?
Oh, okay. So I would just say, you know, more broadly, because my book also covers the Alzheimer's field and, you know, why it has been so hard to come up with a cure and, you know, what the prospects are for the future. And that, you know, that is probably one of the biggest challenges facing us after the pandemic, perhaps. It will still be with us long after the pandemic is under control. So, I think the basic memory science, kind of understanding that memory is distributed and that sometimes the problem isn't that you didn't store the memory. The problem might be that you don't have a good way to retrieve the memory. That's an insight that comes from, you know, basic memory science with mice. Mm-hmm. So that kind of research really provides some distant vision of what might be possible. And then in the nearer term, you know, the field is slowly, slowly moving away from this, the so-called amyloid cascade hypothesis that held that the buildup of these sticky plaques of proteins in the brain that are, you know, one of the two hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease was the bad guy and the initiating event and the thing that if you got rid of it, you know, you would be dealing with Alzheimer's. And that has proven not to be effective in 25 clinical trials. And most people would argue in the 26th and 27th run by Biogen that resulted in the FDA-approved drug Aduhelm. But the researchers I spoke with had a lot of hope about the future. And they said, you know, that cascade hypothesis, you know, there are so many more new ideas in the field now and an openness to new ideas and new tools that make it easier to design smarter clinical trials and to test drugs more quickly. That, you know, they all said, we're not going to have a cure for Alzheimer's in the next, you know, 5 or so years, but we will have treatments, proven treatments that will, if given early enough, slow down the progression of the disease to the point where hopefully people will die of other natural causes before they get to that point where their lives are really disrupted by profound memory loss and the other impairments that go along with Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, I think at the end, it really is a message of hope, not to sound cliche, but I think to be an Alzheimer's researcher, you have to be somewhat optimistic and believe that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And the people I spoke with said, yes, you know, we don't have all the answers yet, but we can see how to get there and we can see that we will get there.
Yes, for sure. And yeah, hopeful message there. Absolutely. So what discoveries about yourself and society along your journey to writing your book, The Memory Thief, surprised you the most?
You know, I think it was the role of luck or bad luck. You know, I was, and it's not just a theme that comes up again and again in the story of the amnestic syndrome and just, you know, the luck of Owen Rivers coming across this article and then connecting with the researchers and making himself available for studies that could easily not have happened. Or the luck of Jed Barish connecting with an anesthesiologist who had done all this work on opioids in mice and in people decades ago. So there's that kind of luck. But also, you know, how easy it is to, as I said before, like forget something that just doesn't fit into your worldview, into your knowledge base, or to just ignore information that just doesn't, you know, it seems inconvenient, it doesn't fit. And I was really struck as I interviewed people that the doctors, people who were doctors, had a really hard time accepting that opioids could damage the hippocampus because they had just never seen it. And so it flew in the face of their clinical evidence. Whereas neuroscientists, when I talked to them, they would like basically finish the sentence like, oh, yes, you know, it shuts down the inhibitory neurons. That makes total sense. And so that kind of the framework of where you're coming from, it seems obvious in hindsight, but it was really brought home to me how much of a difference that makes in terms of, you know, what you see.
For sure. And it also underscores the role of collaborations of people from different departments.
Right, right. And the other thing I learned is that I loved writing this book. It was a prison of my own making, but I had no idea going into it, you know, what I was going to be up against or whether I would enjoy it. It's sort of a leap of faith. But I'm really glad that I did it.
No, that's excellent. So are you a fan of medical mystery shows? And if you are, which one is your favorite?
I'm not really a fan of medical mystery shows. I was a fan of the medical show Scrubs. It wasn't a mystery show though. It was just sort of showing, you know, the life of a doctor. And it was irreverent. And I think, you know, from the doctors that I know, sort of true to life. And I like that slice of life thing. I did watch House for a little while. And I think that was interesting because everyone does love a mystery. But it was also sort of ridiculous in the sense that, you know, the bread and butter of medicine is not these rare, rare cases that one person solves in a stroke of insight. That's really unusual, but it does make good television. But I am interested in mysteries. That's the kind of television that I watch, but it tends to be sort of crime mysteries.
And the real life story that you tell is actually much more gripping even than the imaginary ones.
Yes, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
So I'm actually working on a pilot for a television series, like a half-hour drama. Fiction, so that it will explore many of the themes that came up in the writing of this book, and it sort of revolves around memory loss. But science won't be the main event that's sort of there in the background, but it will really allow me to explore more identity and how it shapes people's decisions. And then I also have an idea for a new book, which is a biography of a scientist, but that's all I'll say at this point. So those are the two big things. And then I'm sort of, I'm doing some video editorial work on the side. But yeah, that's my next voyage is, hopefully a television series.
Oh, those projects sounds very interesting. Yeah. So where can our listeners find more information about your work and also your book?
So I have a website, laurenaguirre.com, LaurenAguirre.com. You can find me on Twitter at LSAguirre, and then, or on LinkedIn. And the book is distributed by Simon & Schuster. So if you want to be able to purchase it or learn more about it from independent bookstores or local, you know, other chains, Amazon, but other places, if you go to the Simon & Schuster website, you'll find the book there, or just search it on Google, The Memory Thief and the Secrets Behind How We Remember, A Medical Mystery. Yeah, so that's how you can find it. I also, I recorded the narration, which was really fun. So it's also available as an audiobook through Audible, but I think soon it will be available through other sort of audiobook sources.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It has been truly fascinating discussion into the world of memory.
It was really enjoyable talking to you. Thank you so much for inviting me on.